it's due, they don't give the, they'll give you the dollar a month, and then it's due.
Yeah.
That's always how they do it. So basically, you have to make the wait ahead.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
That's what they always do.
But then they also leave their long-term debt on the balance sheet, net of maturities. Because they have
the short-term, they have to take out of the long-term.
They didn't have anything in short-term.
When you say net of maturity, what are the net of maturity?
So they had like total maturities due in like 2015 or 2016 for like $42 million. So they took out the $42 million.
Sure, because it's a short term.
Okay, so when I'm plugging it in for the book value of debt, do I add back the maturity? Okay, got it. Thank you.
It makes sense that Verizon's alpha debt ratio is 80%.
I don't know whether it makes sense. Like, that's what's driving it. So technically, you need to make sure that that's, you know,
that's $45 million.
$45 billion operating income. I think Verizon is
EBITDA is $48 billion.
What's operating it?
That's not what the spreadsheet calls for.
Like, what's DUF? That's the next number also is for DUF.
Yeah.
Check it out. That's a high number. You're getting 25, 30. Check the EBITDA, check it out. Okay, folks, let's get settled in. So the last of the quizzes. The last of the quizzes is upstairs to be picked up, and I will take them in this evening because the MBA quizzes go out tomorrow, and if it's going to be a mess if both quizzes are out there. So if you haven't picked up your quiz, why are you guys looking at me like I'm talking French or something? Your quiz is in the usual place. If you have no idea where the usual place is, I'm not going to tell you. No, because it's been three different quizzes. You still don't know? I still have two quizzes for a lot of people, the first two quizzes. And I have a feeling a lot of the third quiz that hasn't been picked up are the same people. I know who you are. All I have to do is look at the names. All three of your quizzes are with me still. So come and pick them up. I don't want them. I really don't. You might as well have them to prepare for the final exam. Which reminds me, two things I want to remind you of. One is the project is due in class. Actually, not in class, by 5 o'clock that Monday, right? So by the end of the... So sometime before 5 p.m., the projects have to come in. So please don't be working on it in that last class. I want you to be done before that, right? The second is your final exam. I have some good news and bad news, and I sent both out. The good news is it's going to be really early. The bad news is it's going to be really early. It's right on that first Wednesday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., which is the 11th. The good news is you're going to be done after May 11th. The bad news is you might be done in a very bad way. if you're not prepared. So, you know, so don't put off preparing until the project is done, because make the project about preparing for the final exam as well. So let's pick up where we left off. We were talking about dividend policy, right? We're talking about the trade-off and dividends. We were talking about the Miller Modigliani argument that dividends don't matter. So somebody remind me again what has to be true for dividends to be irrelevant. What are the assumptions you need to make? Yes, Roy. Investors don't care about whether they receive dividends or capital gains, and the other is that capital markets are open and accessible, that if you pay out too much in dividends, not a big deal, you go out and raise equity. Then we talked about the dividends are bad school, and what's the basis? Well, in the U.S., for about 80 years, dividends were taxed at a much higher tax rate than capital gains, so the argument is don't pay dividends. Today, I want to complete the story. Okay? I want to talk about reasons companies pay dividends. And I want to start off with two bad reasons for paying dividends, and companies use these anyway. The first is what I call the bird in the hand fallacy. And here's how it goes. Investors will say, I like a company that pays dividends over one that doesn't, because a company that pays dividends, dividends I get and they're certain, but capital gains are not. Price appreciation is in the future. Intuitively, it seems to make sense, right? Dividends are in your hands. The check comes to you. Capital gains are kind of fuzzy. You're saying, well, why not? But here's the reason the argument breaks down. It's not the choice between dividends today and price appreciation in the future. It's dividends today versus price appreciation today. Because think about what happens in the ex-dividend day. If I did not pay the dividend, you'd have a higher price. So the notion that dividends are more certain than capital gains is deeply ingrained in value investing. But I think it's false. There's nothing really different about dividends and price appreciation if you compare them apples to apples. So that's one bad reason to pay dividends. They're more certain, investors will reward us. They're not. The second reason given for dividends is that we had a really good year this year. We have a lot of cash that's come through. Therefore, we should pay it out as dividends. Makes sense, right? Dividends are residual, so if you have a lot of cash flows, it was a good year for you, why shouldn't you pay it out as dividends? The problem is dividends are sticky, right? Once you start paying dividends, you're stuck with them. So if this is a good year and you're afraid that it might pass, you're going to get stuck with the dividend policy you don't want to continue. The other is, if you pay this cash out as dividends and next year you have to make a big investment, you have to go out and raise equity, right? Issue shares. You're saying, what's the big deal? I'll issue shares. You don't live in the Miller Modigliani world. It's not costless to issue shares. In fact, let me show you a graph that shows you how expensive it can be to raise money from capital markets, especially for small companies. So this is from a very old study. So the numbers look really, really small, but take them with a grain of salt. But the kind of trends you see here apply still. So what this looks at is the percentage of the issuance proceeds you get as a company that you end up paying out as investment banking fees, transactions costs, etc., to raise the money. So let's take a really small equity issue. So this is a tiny company. It goes out and makes an equity issue of less than $1 million. Look at how much of that $1 million will end up in transactions costs. About 23% of those $1 million will stay with the bankers and transactions costs. So you issue shares for $1 million, you get only $770,000. It is cheaper to issue bonds than stocks, and this is true across the board. When you go out and issue bonds, there is a cost, but that cost will tend to be lower than issuing stocks. And the larger you become as a company, the smaller the cost of issuing new equity or debt. What's this got to do with dividends? If you pay out dividends this year, issue stock next year. Pay out dividends a year after issue. You're on a pathway to spending money you shouldn't be spending. Save that cash to take projects. So those are two reasons I've seen companies give for paying dividends, but those are not good reasons. So let's talk about some good reasons for paying dividends. And along the way, I want you to start thinking about your company and think about whether it pays dividends or doesn't pay dividends. And maybe one of these reasons will apply to why a company either pays dividends or doesn't pay dividends. Here's the first reason. When you're a company and you go out and set a dividend policy, you say, we're going to pay big dividends, we're going to pay no dividends, you attract investors who like that dividend policy. So you pay big dividends, you attract investors who like big dividends. You pay no dividends, you attract investors who like no dividends. It's called a clientele. Once you've created that clientele, it's very difficult for you to change your dividend policy because they bought your shares because of what you do. So we're going to start with that, and we're going to see how the investment clientele varies across companies and how it can trap you into a dividend policy. The second is a signaling story. Signaling story is when you do something to signal to the world that you're a better company than the rest. And I'm going to argue that companies that are that feel much more certain about the future, feel that they can make a lot of money in the future, are more likely to increase dividends because they can sustain those dividends. So we're going to talk about that story and how it can be turned on its head, how you can actually look at an increase in dividends and view it as bad news in some companies. And the third reason for paying dividends is not a noble one, but it happens anyway. Whenever you pay a dividend, think of how the people who've lent money to the company feel, right? Because until you paid the dividend, it was cash in the company. So if you're a lender, the last thing you want the company to do is pay out big dividends. So dividends might be a way you transfer wealth from bondholders and lenders to the equity investors. So let's take each of those explanations. Let's start with a clientele effect. Okay? As I said, you know, when you think about investors, you tend to think about them generically as a big group, but not all investors are made equal. So I'm going to show you the results of one of the most puzzling studies ever done in finance. And this was about 40 years ago, very old study. And this was done at the height of the dividends are bad movement. If you remember that tax rate picture I showed you, in the late 60s, the highest tax rate on dividends was 70%. The highest tax rate on capital gains was 20%. So people looking at the tax code said, this is crazy. Companies should not pay dividends. So this study actually picked a stock that's still around. It's a company called Citizens Utility. It's a Northern New York utility. And what made Citizens Utility unique was they had two classes of shares. Say, that's not unique. Lots of companies have two classes of shares. This company, here's what made the shares different. Class A shares, and let's say they get Class A shares, gets a cash dividend. So $1 per share, you get $1 per share as a cash dividend. Class B shares, and let's say you guys own the Class B shares, get a stock dividend. What is that? You get exactly the same. So if I gave a 1% dividend to them, I give a 1% dividend to you. But for you, it shows up as additional shares. And I give you another advantage. You can convert your shares into Class A shares anytime you want. Class A shares can't convert to Class B, but Class B can convert to Class A. What I've effectively given you as an investor is a choice between either buying a stock on which you get a dividend or buying a stock on which you get exactly the same capital gain. Now, if you think about the tax story that I just told about how the taxes on dividends are much higher than the tax on capital gains, which of these two classes should trade at a higher price? The one on which you get the dividend and get taxed at 70%, the one that you get capital gains and get taxed at 20%. The capital gains should be priced higher, right? That's what these researchers thought they were going to find confirmation of this finding. One of the problems with actually doing empirical research is sometimes the data doesn't agree with you. It says you're wrong. And these researchers actually were courageous enough to come out and say, we found the exact opposite of what we thought we'd find. We found that the cash shares trade at a premium over the capital gain shares. For whatever reason, in this particular company, investors seem to like dividends more than capital gains. People thought it was an aberration. Until another study went to Canada, where this is much more common, and found a dozen companies with exactly the same characteristic. Two classes of shares, cash dividend versus price appreciation. In every single one of these companies, the cash dividend shares trade at a premium. Now, it's strange, but don't jump to the next conclusion. Your next conclusion might be, hey, this shows investors like dividends over capital gains. No, it shows that investors in these companies like dividends more than capital gains. So I'm going to throw out some alternatives, and I think I started on this last session, but let's complete this. If I looked at the people owning shares in Citizens Utility or these Canadian companies, what types of investors do you think I'm going to find? I mean, these are investors who like dividends, obviously, but what type of investors do you think these are going to be? Older investors, poorer investors, pension funds. Why pension funds? Because pension funds pay no taxes at all. They don't care. Older and poorer investors, because you don't pay the 70% tax rate. You might be earning Social Security income, and this might be additional income on which you pay only 10% or no taxes at all. They had older, poorer investors and pension funds. Why did they go to those companies? Because they paid big dividends. So in these companies, you'd accumulated investors who liked dividends. In fact, this study's been built on lots of different ways. So many of these other studies look at dividends across companies and try to find out what kinds of investors own stock in companies that pay big dividends. And guess what they find? Older investors, poorer investors consistently flock to stocks that pay big dividends. Nothing good or bad about it, but that's a reality. If that's the kind of investor base you attract, you better keep paying those dividends or they're going to be really pissed off at you. In fact, the final table I'm going to show you, this is actually from a study that actually ran a regression across dividend yields and companies to see whether there were differences across companies. Firms with older investors tend to pay higher dividends. Or let me phrase that another way. Firms that pay higher dividends attract older investors. So there's causation. I'm not sure which way it goes. But clearly, older investors are attracted to companies that pay big dividends. Wealthier investors tend to go to companies that don't pay very much in dividends. Why? Because you're making a lot of money already. Why do you need the extra dividends? And finally, the bigger the difference in tax rates between dividends and capital gains, the more these tendencies start to become exaggerated across companies. You get the investors you deserve. So when you set a dividend policy, don't be surprised to get people who like that dividend policy. Yeah, I mean, they can sell shares, but in a sense, that's become such a small issue, right? $8.95 on E-Trade. So unless you have this very small, illiquid NASDAQ company, it's probably not going to pay dividends anyway, it's less and less of an issue each year that we look at this process. Any questions on the clientele effect? Now, here's how it can become a trap. I'm going to ask a what-if question here, and I want you to think of creative ways of answering the question. Some of the biggest dividend-paying stocks in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, going back to the 1950s, were utilities. And among the utilities were phone companies. Phone companies were classified as utilities because phone service was a monopoly. For a long time, the only phone company in the world was AT&T. Only phone company in the U.S. was AT&T. And then was broken up into seven phone companies, but they all continued to pay these big dividends. Why were they able to pay big dividends as phone companies? They were monopolies, so what does that tell you? Monopolies delivering a service that everybody needed. Remember, these were days before cell phones. You actually needed a landline phone, and this is the only game in town. Your revenues were predictable. Your earnings were set on cost plus because the regulator allowed you to. And you really didn't have very much in growth investments to make, right? You weren't allowed to go into other businesses, so phone companies would often pay out 75, 80, 85% of their earnings as dividends. And it made sense. Then you get to the 1990s, and then the phone companies discover that the monopolies are starting to melt away. They're melting away because technology is making it easier for people to actually communicate without using phone service. And they're discovering that their business, instead of being a monopoly now, is becoming a competitive business, and it's becoming more like a technology business than the old-time monopoly. And Justin's doing Verizon. Verizon is not an old-time phone company anymore. It's not a monopoly. Its income is constantly under assault. You're saying, so what? Now your investment needs are much higher because you've got to make these new investments to get into new businesses. Your earnings are much less predictable. And you have a dividend policy that's a residue from an older time. So you're the CEO of the company. And I'm going to give you some choices, and you tell me which of these choices you'd make, given that you now have a mismatch between your dividend policy and what you look like as a company. Here's the first one. You can go in front of your stockholders and courageously announce that you're now a new company and you need to cut dividends and you plan to do so. What's going to happen to you if you do that? You're going to lose your job right after you make that speech, so don't be stupid. So cross that out. Partly because these are investors who like dividends. They don't care about your investment needs or what you care about. They say, give me my dividends, I don't care about the rest. Here's the second. You take the craven route. You continue to pay the dividends that you used to pay, and you choose not to invest in these new businesses you should invest in to grow. So essentially, you become a worse and worse company over time. Here's the third choice, and this might appeal to some of you. You continue to pay the dividends out of one window, keeping investors happy, And then you issue shares out of another window to make sure you fund all that growth you need. Kind of silly, because remember those transactions costs? Your investment banker is happy. There's actually a fourth choice. And Lucent actually took this fourth choice. Do you remember Lucent? Lucent used to be Bell Labs. Bell Labs used to be AT&T's R&D division, but when AT&T was thrown into the competitive marketplace, AT&T spun off Lucent as a spun off Bell Labs and gave it this new name, Lucent. Lucent was really a technology company. But one of the problems was Lucent was saddled with a dividend policy that AT&T gave it from its old days. So Lucent had this problem. They had to pay big dividends while investing like a technology company, facing the risk of a technology company. They actually borrowed money to keep growing while paying dividends out of the other window. They almost went bankrupt in 1999 because of that. Justin?
Why don't you not pay dividends and issue shares?
Why don't you not pay dividends? Because you don't pay dividends. You probably don't need to issue the shares in the first place. But you don't even need to issue new shares. If you don't pay dividends, guess what's going to happen? That transition will happen anyway, which is the old investors, that transition has to happen even if you decide, you know, if you issue new shares. But my argument is if all you're worried about is transitioning, it'll happen. It'll just take about 6 months or a year to happen. The only problem is you might lose your job. The solution, and I'm going to ask you this, is there a clearly, all of the choices I've listed for you sound dysfunctional, right? Is there a different choice? And I think the answer is, what did Verizon do with its cell phone business? It created Verizon Wireless, right? It took its technology business and said, rather than treat this all as one company, we're going to take the risky technology part, make it into Verizon Wireless. We're going to issue shares in Verizon Wireless, and we're going to tell people, if you buy those shares, don't expect a dividend, because that's a very different business. But Verizon, we will continue to pay the dividends, like having your cake and eating it too, or eating your cake and having it too, because you can always have your cake and eat it too, but you can't eat your cake and you get it, right? So basically, that's one way in which you might be able to split the difference. Roy? See, switching clientele happens in the market. You know, it's not like one day you can send a transfer slip to your stockholder saying you now. So in a sense, they've got to sell the shares and new shareholders have to buy the shares. That transition is not smoother overnight. And you might lose your job because they're going to be, the people who are leaving are going to be really pissed off while they're leaving. They're going to drag you with them when they go. And by the time 6 months later, a year later, you're back to steady state, you're no longer running the company. Yep.
Can you provide forward guidance?
See, dividend guidance never works. Earnings guidance you can get away with. Dividend guidance never works because you get people are pretty fanatic about dividends. They don't expect dividends to change. Earnings they expect to change, but dividends they don't expect to change. So that's the first possible reason, is maybe you've accumulated investors who like dividends. Here's the second. Maybe you're trying to send a signal. Justin? They didn't sell the shares, but in a sense, they created a separate company just in case they needed to spin it off, right? So they own what? They don't own 100% of Verizon Wireless. And yeah. No, they do now, but they didn't when they initially created it. They created only, they owned a majority so they could consolidate. But they actually allowed investors to buy those shares to create that transition period.
But the shares were bought. So in other words, before the transaction with Vodafone, they were actually Verizon Wireless shares initially.
Yeah. And then they brought them back in-house. But remember, now people no longer think of Verizon as the old phone company. There's now enough separation that you don't have to worry. But in the early 90s, that was a big issue with all the Bell companies. Let's talk about signaling. Anybody here wearing a suit? Why are you wearing a suit today? Okay, so why do we wear suits to work? Or to interviews, that's the other reason, right? I can always tell who's ready for an interview because you got a suit and a tie and it's 95 degrees outside. And so what are you, crazy?
Signaling.
And what are you signaling?
You're signaling that you're
You're signaling that you're willing to make yourself really uncomfortable because you want this job so much. That's a reality, right? And we do this all the time. We do things that make us uncomfortable because it tells the rest of the world something about us that might give us some benefits in the future. You're saying, what's this got to do with companies and dividends? Let's say you're a company who feels really good about the future. You've taken these projects, earnings are going to be good in the future. You go out there and you call a press conference, you give them guidance. Our earnings are going to be really good in the future. Why does that not work usually? Because you have no credibility. Everybody says it. What company comes out and says, well, horrible things are going to happen in the future. So in a sense, what I'm going to ask you to do is put your money where your mouth is. You say, things are so good in the future. Why don't you go out and increase your dividends? How is that signaling? Because remember, dividends are sticky. You wouldn't do this if you were lying to me. So what I'm trying to do is separate those people who lie from those people who are not lying. And one of the reasons I might, one of the ways I might latch on to which the better companies are is by looking at whether you can increase dividends. And there is some evidence that dividends operate as signals to markets. And here's the evidence. These are studies that look at what happens to the stock price of companies when they announce increases of dividends. So this is when the board says, we're going to increase dividends or we're going to decrease dividends. No surprise here. On average, when a company announces it's going to increase dividends, its stock price jumps about 1%. So don't get too excited here. So it's a small increase, 1% on the announcement. When companies announce they're going to cut dividends, the stock price drops about 5%. So let me pause right there. When you announce a dividend increase, the stock price goes up 1%. When you announce a dividend decrease, the stock price drops 5%. That sounds a little disproportional, right? Why do you think that happens? Why is a dividend decrease worse news than a dividend increase is good news? I don't know whether you remember, but I had a graph that showed the percentage of companies each year that increase dividends, decrease dividends, and do nothing to dividends. That was when I talked about dividends are sticky. Go back and look at that slide, because in that slide, you'll find there are about 4 to 5 times more companies that increase dividends than decrease them. Now, that explains the proportionality, which is if you cut dividends, that's a lot worse news than when a company increases dividends, because companies do it so infrequently. So the dividend signaling story is, if you increase dividends, it must be because you expect good things, therefore I'm going to push up your price. But I said signaling stories can be very dangerous. And here's why. Can you think of a scenario where you've invested in a company and you really like the company? The company announces it's going to start paying dividends and you view it as bad news. Why would a company's announcement that it's going to pay dividends be bad news for you as an investor? What is it signaling to you? In other words, let's say this is a high growth company, invested expecting them to have these great projects and not be able to pay dividends, and all of a sudden they announce, we're going to start paying dividends next year. Part of you saying, well, what's changed here? Maybe they don't have the growth projects that they did. And there is some evidence of this when you look at especially companies that initiate dividends for the very first time. So what this looks at is the earnings growth at companies around dividend initiation. So if you look at the earnings growth in 4 years before, 3 years before, 2 years before, 1 year before, the year off, you notice that you increase dividends at the peak. So it's your very best year. But after that dividend increase, if you look at the earnings growth in the subsequent years, you start to see a drop off. In other words, companies initiate dividend often at the peak of growth, and what's coming in the future is often much more bad news. So I tend to be a little skeptical about dividend stories because you can make them cut both ways. And there's one final point about dividends. As investors, we're using dividends to get some information about companies, right? And in a world where this is the only way you got information, there are going to be big changes in stock. But the only information you're getting from the company is the dividend change. You're going to react in huge ways to dividend changes. But let's enrich that world. Let's suppose there are 100 analysts tracking this company and 50 portfolio managers following this company. And they're all doing research on the company, for better or worse. You might actually be getting a lot of this information about the quality of the projects without even looking at the dividends. And in fact, that's in this next blank page. Don't ask me what's going on with Microsoft. I think it's just a conspiracy on the part of Microsoft. The slide should be, the picture should be look okay on your notes. But if you look at that picture, you'll see that the impact of dividend changes has become much smaller now than it used to be 10 years ago, 20 years ago. In other words, if dividend increases were good news in 1985, they're less good news now than they used to be because investors have so many other ways of collecting information. Maybe there's an end game here, which is if companies have been using dividends as a way of signaling, you could tell them, hey, that was okay in 85, but maybe you don't have to do this anymore. There are more efficient ways in which you can send that information to markets where you can get still get believed. Any questions? Yes. Earnings growth, yeah. Yeah, it's not bad, but it's just lower. But remember, you price in, if you have 25% growth company, 20% growth is a negative surprise, right? So it is the same company. It's high relative to other companies, but we never price companies relative to other companies. We price it based on our expectations for this company. So it's still going to be bad news for you if you priced it on that very high growth rate. And there's a final point I made, which is whenever you pay dividends, stockholders might be dancing in the street saying this is good news. But on that same day, when stock price, remember that dividend increases cause stock price increase, the bond price drops. If you decide not to pay dividends, bondholders are happy. If you decide to increase your dividends, bond, so it's actually the inverse of whatever you see with stockholders, you'll often see playing out with bondholders, and you see that in the bond price. So let me summarize. Three reasons why you might pay dividends. One is you've acquired a clientele who like what you do and you're stuck paying that dividend, even though you might not be able to afford it anymore. The second is you're trying to send a signal to markets and using the dividend to send a signal. And the third is that you're trying to rip off your bondholders because they've, in a sense, priced the bonds with that cash in. And you say, if I take that cash out, it's going to transfer wealth to me as a stockholder. Okay. Question? Right. Justin? That's actually a good question. How do you gauge whether you have investors who like dividends? Do Verizon investors like dividends? Well, they pay dividends. There's your answer. If they pay dividends and they've been doing it for 80 years, guess what? Investors in your company like dividends. Do Google investors like dividends? There are no dividends. Google doesn't even pay a dividend. So sometimes the best clues are actually in your history with dividend policy. Well, I mean, it might be less of a pull than it used to be, but the fact that the dividend is paid is attract. But again, if you look at Verizon now versus 20 years ago, the investors buying Verizon now are less dividend addicted, if that's the right word, than the investors who bought it 20 years ago. So look at your company's history. It'll give you some clues about what they're stuck with. So this is actually from surveys, so don't take any of these survey results too seriously. This is what CFOs tell you they think about when they set dividends. Okay? And I want you to, so let's take the first one. So they were read these statements and they're asked, do you agree or disagree with the statement? So first statement, dividend payout ratio affects the price of the stock. 61% agreed, 6% disagreed, and this was the shocking statistic. 33% said, I have no idea. See, that's okay. That's the question. Look across the board. These CFOs have no idea what's going on with dividends. Almost every single question, 30, 35, 40% have no opinion. No wonder dividends are on autopilot. Because these are all fundamental questions. I don't care what your view is, but at least have a view and back it up. Okay? Because almost every single one of those questions has something to do with the trade-offs about what dividends do to the company. So now let's turn to this very practical question. Because the question I've asked you for your company, after you've looked at the payout and the yield and looked at their history and look at what they have and the trade-offs, is I'm going to ask you, does your company pay out too much or too little in dividends? Which is, again, another way of asking, does your company have too much cash, right? You see why it's the same question? When asked, does Apple pay out too much or too little in dividends, it's also a question of $200 billion cash, too much cash. So we're going to set up a framework for doing this. And essentially, we're going to also look at, once you've decided to return the cash, should you do it in the form of dividends or should you buy back stock? So let's set up this process, and there are two ways I'm going to take you through coming up with the right amount to pay in dividends. The first is to, I call this the cash trust nexus, and you're going to see very quickly why cash is in there and trust is in there. Because dividend policy, more than any other aspect of corporate finance, is about trusting managers. If you don't trust them, you're not going to let them hold your cash. The second is what we did with capital structure. How do most companies decide how much to borrow? They look at everybody else in the sector, they look at what they borrowed, and try to be as close as they can. Guess what? Same thing applies with dividend policy. That's how most companies decide how much to pay in dividends. So with the cash trust nexus, there are three questions I'm going to try to answer. First, I'm going to look at your company. So as I describe my company, start thinking about your company. The first question I'm going to look at is, how much did my company return to its stockholders as cash? So this would be an easy one, because I'm going to look at the dividends and the stock buybacks and look at what was actually returned. Second step, I'm going to ask, how much could the company have returned? Potential dividends. That sounds really fancy. It's really simple to compute for your company. You've got actual cash returned, what you could have potentially returned. And if you're one of those lucky people where the company actually returns what it can afford to return, your dividend policy section is done. But if that's not the case, and the company is either holding back cash or returning too much cash, I'm going to let you tell me whether you trust the management of this company to maintain their dividend policy. And that trust is going to be based on the history of how well they've picked projects and how well they've delivered returns for you on your stock. So let's start with the first question, since it's the easiest one. I took my five companies, and I looked at how much each of these companies returned in dividends each year and how much in buybacks. So let me start with Disney. Between 2008 and 2012, Disney returned about $4.5 billion in dividends. But it also returned $15.4 billion in buybacks. Collectively, Disney returned about $20 billion in cash, but most of it took the form of stock buybacks. Vale returned about $23.9 billion in dividends and bought back about $5.7 billion. So it bought back stock, but not as much as Disney. Only about 20% of the cash return took the form of buybacks. If you look at Tata Motors, $51.4 billion in dividends, or 51.4 billion rupees in dividends, and almost no buybacks, 970 million. If you look at Baidu, that was an easy column to draw. No dividends, no buybacks, no cash returned. Remember what I said last session. A company that pays no dividends has a dividend policy. You still have to evaluate, is that the right policy for my company? And the last one, I look at Deutsche, and it's returned about 4.4 billion euros in, I don't know why this became yen, but 4.4 billion euros in cash flows and no buybacks. So that's what these companies have returned. In this stage, if you ask me, have they returned too much or too little, I have no idea. So what I'd like to give you is a way of evaluating how much your company can return to its stockholders, potential dividends. And to do this, I'm going to go to that financial statement that I think is the most honest of the accounting statements, which is the statement of cash flows. Because they tell you everything they do with cash, right? So here's the way I'm going to compute how much you can afford to pay in dividends. So I want somebody to be my guinea pig. You want to be my guinea pig, Justin? I want my cash back when this is all done, though. Okay? So okay, then I'm going to go with Griffin here. Okay. So Griffin, you have a business. You're the equity investor, the only equity investor in the business. How do you measure income to equity investors? Which measure of income do you use? You're going to start with net income, right? So here's the net income. You have $40 in net income. It's accounting earnings. We remember that. So to get to cash flows, you're going to add back depreciation and amortization. Let's say you have $20 in depreciation and amortization. He's feeling rich now. He's got $60 of cash flows. And now the demands start on him. You're a business. Some of that has to be reinvested back for future growth. So let's say you have $20 of CapEx. Give me $20. You also do a lot of stuff on credit. So what you thought was net income, some of that was, you know, accrual income. So you have $20 in working capital needs, so give me $20 in working capital needs. Oh, by the way, you also have some debt payments due of $20. So I'm going to reach for that. But before you pay it back, if you're a going concern and you have old debt coming due, you will tend to borrow money to, in other words, you won't pay it off with equity. So I'll take the 20, but then you'll borrow back the 20. So here's what happens. CapEx is a cash outflow. Working capital is a cash outflow. Debt you repay is a cash outflow, but debt you borrow is a cash inflow. We're done. So that's what you have, $20 left. If this is your business, you can take that $20 and walk out. You're not hurting the business because this is cash left over after you've met every conceivable need. This is your potential dividend. If you choose not to take it out of the business, guess what? That $20 will show up as a cash balance in your business. It'll just sit in your cash register. So now let me take my 20 back before I forget. Yeah.
You said you borrowed that cash back and you pay for dividends. So isn't there some sort of cost?
Well, in a sense, if I kept borrowing money to pay dividends, that's a little problematic, right? So if you feel that, but some of the debt I'm going to take on simply because, not because I'm trying to borrow money to pay dividends, but I'm borrowing money just to replace past debt. Remember, your debt ratio doesn't change because what you're doing is the old debt was going out and you said, you know what, I can afford to have 20% debt. So you're basically just borrowing to get back. If I borrowed $60 in debt to pay dividends, and you can say, I can't maintain that. So when you look at the debt you borrow, one of the questions you will have to examine is this an unusually high amount of debt, or is this the debt I'm borrowing just to keep my company where it is? So what you're looking at when you look at this is it's called free cash or equity. That's just a fancy way of saying this is the cash left in the till at the end of the year after every conceivable need has been met. You can compute that for a publicly traded company fairly easily. Every single item on that comes from the statement of cash flows. You give me your financial statements as a company, you can compute what the company could have paid in dividends, and in those same statements of cash flows, I should get the dividends and the buybacks you have. In fact, I'll give you a shortcut you can use, but this shortcut works only if you have a company in steady state. What does that mean? A company that's decided that 40% of its reinvestment is always going to come from debt, 60% from equity. So let's go back and reset the game. Let's say you have $100 in net income. And you've decided to invest $50 of that $100 back into the business. If you use no debt, you're going to have 100 minus 50, $50 left over, right, after reinvestment. But let's say you borrow 40% of whatever you reinvest always from debt. So this isn't like you're pushing up debt. This is your optimal debt ratio. You've decided that 40% of every CapEx you take comes from debt. So you have $100 still as your net income. Your $50 is your reinvestment, but 40% of that, $20, comes from debt. How much do you have to come up with as the equity investor then? You just have to come up with the remaining 30. So basically what I've done here is started with the net income and subtracted from the net income only what I have to come up with as an equity investor. And the more I borrow, the less I have to come up with. It's just a different way of arriving at what I came up with on the previous page. But that's my free cash flow equity. That is what I can afford to pay out. So let me try this for Disney so you can see this process work through. I could do the free cash flow equity for just last year and compare it to dividends last year, but the problem with that is free cash flow equity jump all over the place. So in any given year, I don't know what I'm going to find. So what I did was I took 5 years of data, and in fact the spreadsheet that goes with this part for your project does up to 10. So you don't have to do 10, you can do 3, you can do 5. I'm just getting a sense of what do numbers look like across time. And I'll tell you what the numbers look like for Disney. I start with the net income, which had about $23.9 billion. I netted out depreciation against CapEx. Do you see what I'm doing with that? You add depreciation, you subtract CapEx. I'm just saying, let me save myself some trouble. That's called net CapEx, the difference between CapEx and depreciation. I subtracted out my change in working capital. And then I came to my free cash or equity. If I didn't even think about debt, that's where I'd stop. And over those 5 years, Disney had about $17.3 billion in cash flows from just its operations. But they did borrow money and they did retire debt. And if I bring the debt in, they added another $9 billion in cash flows because they borrowed more money than they repaid. Over this five-year period, Disney borrowed $9 billion more than they repaid. So if I count that cash flow in, they could have returned about $27 billion. But there Griffin's point comes in, which is you can't keep doing this. You can't borrow money and pay dividends. So what I did also is I computed what their free cash flow to equity would have been if they'd stayed at their optimal debt ratio. In other words, I said, you know what, this is crazy. I can't keep paying our dividends every year from borrowed money. So if the number I would focus on in this particular page is that $18.065 billion. What does that tell me? Given Disney's operating cash flows and given their debt ratio, this is how much they could have afforded to return over the 5 years, $18.065 billion. What they actually returned was about $19.9 billion. They were able to pay the extra $1.8 billion because they borrowed money. Doesn't mean it's a bad thing, because remember, we found Disney to be an under-levered company, so I can understand what they're doing. But over this five-year period, Disney returned almost all of its free cash flow to equity investors and more. So free cash flow to equity is what you can afford to return, and then I look at what you actually returned, and then I have to still make a judgment, but at least now I have a measure of what you could have paid out. Now, let me use the shortcut so you can see how this works. I'm going to take you back to 1996, when Microsoft was the greatest growth company on the face of the earth. It was. 1986, it went public. Over the next 10 years, it grew from nothing to this huge company. So in 1996, I took a look at Microsoft and had $2.173 billion in net income. A lot of net income. Their net CapEx was only $14 million. They invested almost nothing in CapEx. That sounds strange, right, for a high-growth company. Usually high-growth companies have lots of reinvestment. Why am I not seeing that in the CapEx here? It's a software, but continue the story. What's the biggest CapEx for a software company? Well, if they had the depreciation was only $480 million. Compared to the net income, it's still small, right? What's the biggest CapEx for a software company? They don't buy land and building. It's small. It's still tiny in the large. You think cloud computing, maybe servers, the bigger issue? 1995, that wasn't the issue. It's R&D. R&D is your biggest CapEx. And what do accountants do with R&D? Screw it up big time. They treat it as an operating expense. Your biggest CapEx is in the is already netted out to get to the net income. They had $2 billion in R&D expense that year. So that's already been subtracted out to get a net income. That's where the big reinvestment went. So that's why their net CapEx looks low. It's because their big CapEx has already been subtracted out to get to net income. Their working capital needs were minimal. But if I took the $2,176 million, subtract the net CapEx and subtract the change in working capital, and remember in 96, Microsoft had no debt. Their free cash flow to equity would have been $2,127 million. So what does that tell me? In 1996, Microsoft could have returned $2,127 million in cash. But here's what it actually did. It paid no dividends. It bought back no stock. It returned no cash. So I have a very simple procedural question. I could have returned $2,127 million in cash. I returned nothing. Where on Microsoft's balance sheet would I find this $2,127 million? See my question? Would it be in projects? Why can't it be in projects? Because I've already subtracted R&D and CapEx, so I've already taken... It can't be in inventory or accounts receivable because I've already subtracted our change in working capital. So what's left? Cash. That's exactly where it'll go. Microsoft's... I'm glad nobody said retained earnings. If you're thinking about it, snip it in the bud. Wrong side of the balance sheet, right? Because in this case... Your cash balance will increase by $2,127 million. In 1997, Microsoft had free cash flow equity of $3 billion, paid no dividends, bought back no stock. So tell me what happens in 97? Their cash balance increases by another $3 billion on top of what they already had. 1998, they had a $5 billion free cash flow equity. Why the jump? Take a look at all the Windows upgrades, and you'll see years where you have big cash flow jumps for Microsoft. $5 billion, paid no dividends, bought back no stock, cash balance. See what's happening? Each year you do this, you're building on an existing cash balance. By the time you get to 2002, Microsoft had a $43 billion cash balance. And at that time, it was the largest cash balance in corporate history. Now, of course, it's been drowned out by the Apples and the Googles of the world. But the point I'm making is to get to that $43 billion in cash, this is what they had to do year after year after year. They had to have big free cash flow equity that they didn't pay out in dividends. How do you think Apple ended up with $220 billion in cash? isn't manna from heaven, doesn't pop up magically on your balance sheet. It's a result of year after year after year of not paying out what you can afford to that causes cash balances to become big. Yep. I'm not. Did I say it was bad? I said this is how you get big cash balances. We'll come back and talk about whether that's good or bad in a minute, right? They don't have to, unless you put pressure on them. It left to themselves, maybe that's what will happen. Maybe that's why the Russian companies don't pay out very much in dividends.
So what's the downside?
That they control the cash and they could do stupid things with your cash. That's the downside, right? Then what? They don't own the company, you do. What's the incentive of the company to do anything? Managers left to themselves will serve their own interests, right? This goes back to the first section. What's corporate governance all about? U.S. stockholders putting pressure on managers to do the right thing. So rather than ask what's the incentive of managers, the question you have to be asking is, what happens when managers don't put stockholder interests ahead? And in some, not they collectively. It's got to be somebody who has enough at stake and has enough power to push for it. And I'm going to show you an example of what happens at a company like that. But it doesn't happen at all companies. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about why some companies get targeted and others don't. Google has $80 billion in cash. I haven't heard a single person raise an issue with it, and they shouldn't. We'll talk about why some companies get targeted for having big cash balance and others don't. But it's a natural consequence of holding back cash. Yes? The question? No? So, question. It does, but the retained earnings is a separate issue. What's the definition of retained earnings? It's net income minus dividend. You can have no change in retained earnings and a big change in cash because free cash flow equity and net income are not the same thing. So whenever you talk about free cash flow equity, it's always on the asset side of the balance sheet. When you talk about net income versus dividends, it'll be the retained earnings part of the balance sheet. Now, just as a detour, I said, let's assume that you're looking at the dividend policy of a bank. You say, can I do this for a bank? It's a little problematic, and here's why. CapEx, depreciation, and working capital are close to impossible to compute for a bank. What's a CapEx for a bank? Who the heck knows? So I'm going to draw on something I did when we talked about capital structure to measure free cash flow equity for a bank. I'm going to start with net income because I have that for a bank. And I'm going to define reinvestment as not reinvestment in land, building, equipment, and machinery, but reinvestment in regulatory capital. Why? Because to grow as a bank, you need to grow your regulatory capital, or the regulators are going to shut you down. So I took Deutsche. There's my net income each year. And then from that net income, I subtracted out what I estimated they will have to invest in regulatory capital. And it's a big number because when I started this process in 2013, Deutsche was already undercapitalized. They had too little regulatory capital, and it looked like they'd have to dig out of that hole over the next 5 years. You're saying, so what? Take a look at my free cash flow equity. It's net income minus reinvestment in regulatory capital, right? How much dividend can Deutsche pay out next year? Minus $3.993 billion. How much can in 2 years? In fact, if these numbers are right, Deutsche should not be paying dividends. But Deutsche actually was. You're saying, how do you explain it? That's the dysfunctionality of dividends. They paid dividends because they were afraid of what investors would do to them. And while they were paying dividends through one window, guess what they were doing to the other one? They were issuing new shares to cover the regulatory capital. It's insane. But that's exactly what happens when you get stuck on a dividend policy and you can't get out of it. So if you, no, none of you is doing a bank, but if you're doing a bank, this is how you'd adapt free cash flow equity to get that. So I did this at the start of 2016 for every publicly traded company in the world. I computed the dividends, I computed the free cash flow equity. Take a look at the graph. Let's see what bucket your company might end up in. Because here are the four buckets you could conceivably in. First, you can have companies with, so when you look at the graph, the very first grouping, I think, is companies with negative free cash flow equity that pay no dividends. Does that make sense? Yeah, negative free cash flow equity shouldn't pay dividends. So those companies are doing exactly what you'd expect them to. Then I looked at companies with negative free cash flow equity that pay dividends. That's a little insane, right? That's like Deutsche. Maybe it's just a 1-year problem, but that can happen. Then I looked at companies with positive free cash flow equity that pay out less than that free cash flow equity as dividends. What's happening at these companies? These are like Microsoft. They're building up cash. I also looked at companies with positive free cash flow equity that don't pay dividends. They're also going to be building up cash. And the last grouping of companies I looked at were companies with positive free cash flow equity that pay out more than that free cash flow equity as dividends. So they're doing what Deutsche is doing, which is they're digging themselves into a hole. So there are only five groupings: negative free cash flow equity, positive free cash flow equity, no dividends, large dividends. So basically, that's the comparison that animates how we think about dividends. Because when you make that comparison for your company, and as I said, the statement of cash flows is where you should go to collect the information, you're going to get a measure of how much your company pays out in dividends and buybacks and what it could have paid out. So let me talk about what happens when you choose not to pay dividends, just like Microsoft. In the case of Microsoft, nothing happened to the company between 1996 and 2002, partly because the company was doing so well and partly because Bill Gates was running the company, and effectively there's no point even challenging him. But this is a different company in a different era, and let's talk about what happened at this company. And this is, I think, the danger you run into when you start accumulating cash as a company. You guys might be familiar with the history of Chrysler, but Chrysler almost went bankrupt in 1981. The original bailout got bailed out. It got back on its feet, but even in 1985, Chrysler was the shakiest of the U.S. automobile companies. A new CEO came in at Chrysler, a guy called Lee Iacocca, and he turned Chrysler around. You know how he turned it around? What was the thing he introduced that allowed Chrysler to become a successful company? And because it had almost no cash balance, was very mildly positive. Close. It was the Dodge Caravan, the very first minivan. And it saved Chrysler as a company. Every day when I'm in a CVS parking lot, I curse Lee Iacocca. I said, "This guy's ruined my life." Okay? Those big minivans taking up three parking spots, you know, people driving them have no idea what's on the right, what's on the left, what's in front, what's behind. Yeah. But it saved the company. So this graph actually traces out Chrysler's cash buildup from 1985 through 94. So each year, here's what I did. I computed the free cash flow equity each year. So that's how much they could afford to pay out. I computed what they actually paid out, the dividends. I took the difference. So let's take 1985. They could have paid out a bit. So look at the axis on the left. So they could have paid out about $1.5 billion. They actually paid out $200 million. So they took the $1.3 billion I put into the cash balance. And each year, I took the change, the difference between those two, and built up my cash balance. By the time you get to 1994, if you look at the cash balance, it's about $8.5 billion. That doesn't sound like much, right? After the Apple $200 billion, Microsoft $43 billion. But here's what made it large. Apple's entire value as a company was $30 billion, and its cash balance was almost 30% of the company. The way to think about Chrysler's value was $30 billion, cash was $9 billion. Or $8.5 billion. Chrysler was 30% cash, 70% automobile company by 1994. And unlike Microsoft and Google, which don't attract much attention, Chrysler attracted the attention of an investor, a guy called Kirk Kerkorian. I don't know whether the guy is still alive, but he's like 105 years old. This was when he was a youthful 91, I think. So he targeted the company. And he was very clear. He said, Chrysler has too much cash. They should return the cash to their stockholders. And what do you think Chrysler's initial reaction was? It's like 2 6-year-olds fighting, right? So Kerkorian says, "You have too much cash." Chrysler says, no, we don't have too much cash. Their initial defense was, "We need the cash because we're a cyclical company." And that has a little bit of good sense, right? You're an automobile company. You're going to have good years and bad years. But let's see if, in fact, that argument makes sense. You might not remember, but 89 through 91 was actually a pretty bad recession period. So they said, we need the cash just in case there's a recession. I went back into this graph and looked at that 89 through 91 time period. Recession. And during that recession, Chrysler burned through about $500 million in cash. You ready for an algebra problem? If the last recession lasted 2 years and Chrysler burned through $500 million in cash, how long does the next recession have to last for you to need $8.5 billion in cash? About 17 years, 34 years, whatever it is. So basically, you're running the company in case there's a 17-year, 20-year recession. This is like a guy who runs in the backyard every time it rains and starts building an ark saying, this is the big one, I've got to get ready. You cannot run a company for a worst-case scenario. That makes no sense. So that argument fell flat very quickly. You know what Chrysler's second argument for holding the cash was? We might have to do a big acquisition. That went down really well because the minute the investors heard that, they said, no way, we're not going to let you do a big acquisition. Chrysler's problem was that it was in a bad business. Investors saw it was in a bad business. They did not trust the company with the cash. Kerkorian and Chrysler fought this out for about a year and a half, but Chrysler eventually had to give in. There's no trust. They had to return $5 billion in cash because investors put pressure. But investors put pressure because they didn't trust Chrysler with that cash because of the business they were in. And that's what separates some companies from others. The less people trust you with cash, the more pressure there's going to be to build up on you. Justin, you had a question? No, but we know exactly how much cash they had. They had $3 billion in cash to $2.5 billion. So that's actually the cash balance right there. I'm sorry?
You said it's 89 to 91, right?
89 through 91, yeah. They started with $3 billion. So look across to the axis over there. So they started with $3 billion in cash, and they went down to $2.5 billion. That's the bill. So when you see big cash balances, not all companies get away with accumulating big cash balances. So here's what I'd like you to do. When you get a chance, go into your company's statement of cash flows. We can do it for 3, maybe 5 years. Do it for 5 years. Compute the free cash flow equity for your company. So net income, capex, depreciation, every single line item is right there. So work down to compute the free cash flow equity. In that same statement of cash flows, look to see how much your company paid in dividends and what it bought back in stock, because those are cash flows as well. As I said, don't focus on just 1 year, 2015. Look at 2014, 2000. Maybe across a five-year period, do what I did for Disney. How much could my company have returned? How much did it actually return? Because that's going to be the basis for the framework that I'm going to give you for deciding what to do next, is that comparison between what you returned versus what you could have returned. And this matrix actually captures how to think about dividend policy. So basically, let's start with a framework. You compare the free cash flow equity you have as a company to dividends and buybacks. So collectively, what could have been returned to what was actually returned. For a few companies, those two numbers will be very close. If you're doing Con Ed, for instance, Con Ed returns about 98% of its free cash flow equity to investors. It has no use for your cash. But for most of your companies, one of two problems is going to happen. One is your company pays out too little in dividends, like Microsoft. It's building up a cash balance. And here's a question you need to ask with that company. Do I trust this company with my cash? And what are you going to base it on? By the time you do dividend policy, you already should be pretty familiar with your company, right? You looked at their investment policy and looked at whether their return on capital is higher than the cost of capital. You looked at their regression beta and computed a Jensen's alpha for the company. If your company has had a history of picking good projects and delivering positive Jensen's alphas, guess what? You're far more likely to trust the company. That's the reason Google is under no pressure. I mean, as a Google investor, what do you have to complain about? As an Amazon investor, nothing to complain about. You feel pretty secure. It might be temporary, but you feel pretty secure. You don't put pressure. If you don't trust the company because it has a history of taking bad projects or doing stupid things with the cash, of course you should demand the cash back. It's your cash. And those are the companies that activist investors tend to target. Let's look at the other half of the equation. Let's say you're a company that pays out too much in cash, like Deutsche. Again, the question I'm going to ask you is, do you have good projects? Because if you have good projects and you're paying out too much in cash, you're doing double damage to yourself. Not only are you digging a hole for yourself by paying out too much in dividends, but because you're paying too much in dividends, you're probably not taking investments you should have been taking, those good projects. There, I'm going to argue you should be cutting dividends. You should find a way to put cash into those projects because you're hurting yourself by not taking those projects. And the final scenario is the worst one. This is a company that has bad projects and pays out too much in dividends. You see why it's problematic? If you ask this company to cut dividends, what are you afraid they might do? They'll take the cash and take more bad projects. This is a company that has an investment problem. Unless that investment problem is fixed, the dividend problem will keep coming back over and over and over again. So I want to present what you're going to find. So basically, there are four possible scenarios, right? You're a company that pays out less in dividends than your free cash flow equity in your good projects, less in dividends than your free cash flow equity in your bad projects, more in dividends than free cash flow equity in good projects, more in dividends than bad projects. I drew them as a matrix so you can see where your company falls. Let's take your best case scenario. You're a company with great projects. You have a great history, and you're paying out less in dividends than your free cash flow equity. Google or Facebook would be there. Those are the companies that have the maximum flexibility to accumulate cash and do whatever they want with dividends. Why? Because you trust them. If you have a company with bad projects, a poor history, and you're accumulating cash, those are the companies that the Carl Icahns and the Kirk Kerkorians target, because those are the companies where they feel the cash needs to be returned. If you're a company which is paying out too much in cash and has good projects, my advice is find a way to pay less in cash and put the money into projects. And finally, if you're a company that pays out too much in dividends and you have bad projects, you got to find a way to fix those bad projects before you fix your dividend policy, because everything is coming out of that investment problem. So that's the way I like to think about companies. And in fact, when you have three or four or five companies in your group, when you've got your free cash flow equity and dividends and returns and cost of capital, put them on the matrix. See where they fall, because in a sense, that does your dividend analysis for you, because you can see where your company falls and you can draw conclusions based on that. So let me go back to Microsoft. I showed you the history of Microsoft in 96, 97, 98, and by 2002, Microsoft had accumulated $43 billion in cash. I went back and looked at equity research reports from 2002. Not a single one mentioned this as a problem. But 2 years later, in 2004, right after the tax law changed, and I talked a little bit about this last session, Microsoft paid the biggest dividend in history, $33 billion. See, why would a company that felt no pressure in 2002 feel the pressure to pay dividends in 2004? Two things changed. One was, you might not remember, but the Justice Department actually targeted Microsoft in 2002 and 2003 based on the fact that they felt that Microsoft was misusing its monopoly power by controlling Windows. So there was that Justice Department. And there was actually talk about breaking Microsoft into Windows and all its... Because their argument, and there's actually a basis for this, is there's a reason nobody's ever been able to come up with a PC version of Word, PowerPoint, etc., because Microsoft, by working with Windows, was always able to make its Office system work much better than everybody else. So WordPerfect and all the different programs got pushed out of the way. So that was the basis. It wasn't going anywhere, but it scared markets. The other was, early in this class, I said Microsoft is a successful company, but its success comes from two big investments they made. One is Windows, the other is Office. And they made both in the first 5 years of their existence. So 5 years of their existence, you're saying, this is a great company. This is like bringing a kid up from the minor leagues. In first five at-bats, he has two home runs. 12 at-bats later, he struck out the last 12 times. His two home runs, now in 17 at-bats. You're saying, let's give him a chance, he's going to come back. 36 at-bats later, still two home runs, nothing's happened. At some point in saying, maybe all he had in his tank was two home runs, he's hit them, and he's done. Between 2000 and 2002, it's very subtle how this happens, but at companies, somehow, investors seem to come to that realization or a belief that this is it, the company is kind of done. And for Microsoft, that happened in 2003 and 2004. You're saying, that suddenly? Take a look at Apple's history. It happened in almost 3 months, one summer. The summer of 2001, the company went from being a company that could do nothing wrong in the eyes of the market to a company that could do nothing right. It happened almost like, you say, what happened here? But when that happens, you can't fight the market and say, you guys are crazy. You have to accept the fact that people have lost trust in you, and you have to respond accordingly. So for better or worse, Microsoft returned the cash saying, you don't trust us, here's the cash. Renee? So
if you pay dividends, yep. That not be the same as dividends
that. Let me ask you a question. Is it ever wrong to signal the truth? They have run out of ideas. They ran out of ideas in 1993. Everybody knows they've run out of ideas. So signaling what everybody has already come to a recognition of is never wrong. It's like people who are 500 pounds overweight saying, if I wear something to cover myself, would I be signaling that I'm fat? You know what? You're going to be fat no matter what, right? So, or, you know, my son will not wear a jacket in winter. He said, if I wear a jacket, I'll be telling people I'm cold. You are cold. I can see you're cold. You're shivering. Wear the damn jacket. So there's something. Sometimes it's good to recognize that things have changed and let the world know, hey, you know what? We don't have that growth prospect we used to. Yeah. After the special dividend, they started paying a small dividend, but they also started buying back tons of stock.
So the special dividend is like, it's not a sticky dividend.
It's not, it's a one-time dividend. So basically everybody knew this was it, but they then started buying back tons of stock. Microsoft was one of the biggest buyers back of stock between 2003 and 2012, because they said, look, you know, you don't trust us, we have to give you the cash back. And that's a sensible thing to do, you know. So here's what we're going to do for the last part of the class. Okay? You can relax. You're going to be stockholders in companies. And these are companies you're familiar with because these are companies I've tracked through this class. I'm going to be the CEO of each of these companies, and I'm going to ask you to trust me with your cash, and I'm going to let you make the judgment. So I'm going to take you back, Disney, in 2002, and I'm the CEO. So who am I? Who was the Disney CEO in 2002? Michael Eisner. You're saying, so what? You're going to see in a minute why that's going to matter, because you have a history with me. And the history is I've treated you like dirt for the last 15 years. And you remember, right? So this is 2003, and here's what the numbers look like. Between 94 and 2003, Disney could have paid out $969 million a year. That was their free cash flow equity. They paid out only $639 million. So they held back about $330 million every year. And if you do that for 10 years, that's going to add up to a fair amount of money. That's going to be about $3.3 billion. With interest, it worked out to about a $4 billion cash balance. So I have $4 billion of your cash that I've accumulated. Now I'm going to give you some sense of what I've done with your money over the last 10 years. Between 94 and 2003, I've generated return on equity 2% lower than your cost of equity. Oh, by the way, your stock has done about 3% worse than the market for the last 10 years. So your Jensen's Alpha is negative, your EVA is negative. And all of this was triggered by a big acquisition that I did of Cap Cities about 7 years ago, which I told you was going to be the greatest acquisition on the face of the earth. You ready? So you have my history. You can see why we got into this trouble. And I have $4 billion of cash and say, will you trust me with your cash? What do you think your answer is going to be? Of course not, right? And not because you're greedy, but because you're afraid of what I will do to your cash. And does the fact that I'm Michael Eisner affect your decision? It will, because remember the arrogance I showed in the good times? This is why when I talk to CEOs, I say, be good to your stockholders in the good times, because there will be bad times. And they will remember. And in this case, you will remember. You should remember, and you can say, give me the cash back. And in fact, you could argue that in 2003, Disney lost its capacity to accumulate cash when it made that big decision in 96 to acquire Cap Cities. And it's one reason when companies do big acquisitions, I would caution managers. Because when you do a big acquisition, it's like putting all your chips on one number on the table. And if it pays off, great. But if it doesn't, you've lost the flexibility to pay dividends for a generation. So in 2003... I wouldn't blame you if you said, I want my cash back. And in fact, that's what investors were demanding. They wanted cash back. In fact, they went further. Not only did they want the cash back, they wanted me out of the top management position. And they succeeded. And I was replaced by Bob Iger. So this is 5 years later. I'm now Bob Iger. You're now stockholders in Disney. And this is how things have changed. Remember those bad projects I was taking before 2003? They've now become good projects. I've improved my project choice. My Jensen's Alpha has gone from being a big negative number to a big positive number. And instead of holding back cash, I've actually been returning more cash than I've available to you each year. So I've changed as a company. But I want to kind of get some freedom back on dividends. So I come to you and say, look, for the last 5 years, I've been giving you all the cash we have. But I've changed, right? I've taken good projects. I've done well for you. And then I ask you for permission to change dividend policy so that I can hold back some cash. I'm not assuming that everybody's going to say okay, but you can see that I'm playing a much stronger hand here because I'm coming in with a history where you're more likely to trust me. So by 2009, this is exactly what Disney did. They went in front of their stockholders and said, we're going to bring down our stock buybacks because we feel that we have good investments. We're going to buy Marvel. And they didn't know this, but Lucasfilms, Shanghai, Disney. But they were able to do that because they built up credibility. The way I describe this is when companies do good things, it's like making deposits in a bank. So when they have a good year, it's a deposit in the bank. You have a bad year, you have a withdrawal. So if you make 7 good years and then you make a withdrawal, I'm okay with that. But you have 1 good year and 7 years of withdrawal, so the 7th year I'm saying, you know what? You're overdrawn. And that's essentially what I'm demanding. Give me the cash back. I don't trust you anymore. It's a bank of trust that you're making the deposits in, and dividend policy rides on that trust. Final twist, in 2013, Disney was back to accumulating cash. But now it was doing it from a position of strength. Its returns on capital were good. Its Jensen's alpha was still good. So in 2013, if you said, am I okay with accumulating cash? I probably will get the freedom to accumulate cash. But to show you that this story is never quite done. In 2016, if I were Bob Iger and you're stockholders at Disney, and I've accumulated cash again, would you be a little more wary about letting me accumulate the cash now? We talked about what's happened to the management team under Iger, right? They're all gone. There's a vacuum below him, so the corporate governance problem. You also have ESPN. Their cash cow has become a lot shakier as we cut the cable connection. Today, I'm not sure Disney would be allowed to accumulate cash again. Things change, and you've got to be responsive to what investors are demanding. So I'm going to leave you with one final example. I took Vale, and I did exactly what I did for Disney. I took a period of time, computed the free cash flow equity. The free cash flow equity that Vale had was about $19 billion. That's pretty good, right? But here's what they paid in dividends, $43 billion. How does a company with $19 billion in free cash flow equity pay $43 billion? Do they have a problem? Of course they have a problem. So I'm Vale's CEO, and you're my stockholders, and I get up there and say, you know what, I have a dividend problem. We can't pay these dividends anymore. I'd like to cut dividends. Sounds like a reasonable request, right? But here's the catch. Vale has 2 classes of shares, voting and non-voting shares. You guys got the non-voting shares. And in return for your shares being non-voting, I also agreed to pay out 35% of my own. The reason I'm in a dividend problem is because of those non-voting shares. So now I'm asking you for the permission to cut dividends, right? If you're reasonable people, what would you demand in return? You demand voting rights. And guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to say no. I'll keep paying the dividend. The control is the biggest enemy. We talked about dysfunctional dividend policy. Managers would rather be in control of a bankrupt company than give up control and make the company healthy. Much of Latin America, we have this problem now. In Brazil particularly, companies are paying dividends. They can't afford to pay out. But the people running these companies are so intent on keeping control of these companies that they'd rather continue with the dividend policy and go bankrupt than cut dividends and do the sensible thing. So that's it. I will see you on whenever, Monday.
No, of course. But for example, I haven't done the dividend policy thing so far.
But if I'm assuming it is a growth company.
But I'm saying, where is the assumption even coming? Dividend policy, looking at what they paid us and what they could have afforded to pay us.
Uh-huh.
Then you're asking, does it make sense?
Oh,
right. So
yeah.
I don't see why growth is even an issue. I'm not asking you to. I mean, but the only place where I'm going to ask you for growth is when we get to the last phase, when I ask you for valuation. Yeah, growth will matter for valuing the company. But in any the analysis so far,
just
I don't think it's
okay.
Similar.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then the second question is the cost of equity according to the regression data and the bottom up data that I've done is like 4%. Do you think the
no way? How would the bottom up beta be get 4%?
Because I did bottom up beta based on operating income of four segments, which are refining.
No, but how do we get such a low unlevered beta? Because if I put 4% on the bottom up beta, there isn't a single sector in my data set that has a bottom, that's an unlevered beta below 0.6. So what was the unlevered beta that gave you such a low cost of equity?
Oh, it's on the Bloomberg, it's like 1.4. And then the
you
one
don't
I do.
Have a bottom up, but bottom up beta, you average across companies. So if you tell me your cost of equity is 4%, the only way you can have a cost of equity of 4% is if your unlevered beta started like 0.1.
No, I'm saying the difference between the cost of equity done with the regression beta on Bloomberg and the bottom up beta that I've calculated.
Yeah. That's why we compute differences. They're never different. Why would we do it?
Mm-hmm. But do you think there would be a big problem if I use the bottom-up data compared to the...
No, you should use the bottom-up.
Okay, all right. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I guess what I went wrong was I ended up...
So your value change is wrong. That's
the
one point.
That's the one. But I was wondering, was if this was 150, I would have done it right, I think.
Yeah. Let's see what else is wrong. What's this part right there?
Oh, that was my actual, just like crossed up because I made a math error, so I was like, wait, this is the number that looked right. And then that was, this is the answer I would have got if this was 100.
But where's your, so you take the value, so I'm not even sure what, where is it solving? I didn't see the cost of capital being solved.
Oh, this was the. So
yeah, but where is the X solved for? I didn't see the X.
The X, this is where the.
But I'm saying that number is wrong.
Yeah.